Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon.
Okay, welcome everybody. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us on Zoom for the first time. I like to start class by introducing a topic and having you talk with each other for just a couple of minutes before we meditate. And I try to coordinate it with the topic of the class. And I was thinking of riffing a little bit on Memorial Day or Memorial Day. Labor Day, Memorial, Veterans Day, where are we? Memorial Day, which I mostly just want to talk shit about nationalism and the kind of ignorance of our culture. But I thought maybe really Memorial Day is about death. It's about memorializing, remembering dead soldiers. And I'm going to definitely go beyond, sort of nationalist, soldier, army, death, just to human death and impermanence. And I'm going to talk a little bit about war tonight, since that's what this sort of American holiday really is about, people who die in war, soldiers who die in war. But the topic for you to do in small groups is just like your relationship to death and memorial. Like, how often do you remember that you're impermanent and that you're going to die and that all of the people that you like are going to die? All the people that you don't like are going to die. Everybody, like, we're all in this process of death, this process of life and impermanence. And we'll do a meditation, one of the meditations that the Buddha encourages is to reflect on the impermanence of the body. The body as a corpse in different stages of decay, and as a regular practice to turn toward yourself and be like, this very much alive body is going to die and is going to decay, and the elements are going to disperse and the worms are going to eat my face. Unless you get burned, right? Unless you burn the body. But if you don't burn the body, like just that kind of natural process of death and decay. And so reflect for a moment on your relationship to remembering that you're impermanent, remembering that your loved ones are impermanent. If Memorial Day is a thing for you about friends or relatives that have died in the armed services in wars or whatever, you can talk about, remembering that. Jeff asked me, next week I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be on retreat, so I'm going to have a sub. And my sub next week is Ward Robinson, who teaches a Friday night class connected with us, and he subs for me sometimes. And Ward has a tattoo right where he can see it on this. He doesn't have a lot of tattoos, he just has a couple, but he's got this tattoo right on his arm where you can see it, and it says today I may die. And I remember when I saw that, I was just like, what a fucking cool tattoo. She just remember every today I may die, instead of being in denial, instead of being in delusion, instead of being in this sort of acknowledging it. Today could be it. So talk about death for a minute, your relationship to death, to impermanence, to yourself, to grief, whatever you want to talk about. Take like a minute or so to, say some few, kind of my relationship to death is like this. Don't take a long time, be concise, and just do groups of two or three. And at home, I'll put you in breakout rooms. Talk about remembering death. We'll meditate. I'll offer some instructions, and then we'll have some talk and discussion about remembering what we need to remember, memorializing, recollecting. Death is one of the subjects for frequent recollection. So find a way to sit that's relaxed and upright so that your body is in a posture that feels sustainable, that you can maintain with relative stillness. It's always useful as you begin a meditation to establish an attitude of friendliness, of kindness, self-acceptance. And for the first few minutes of this sitting, just mindfulness of the impermanent, changing nature of the sensations of your breath. Disengaging from the thinking mind, bringing full awareness into the feeling body. Feel your body sitting here. Feel your body breathing. And try to ignore what your mind wants to think about. Direct your full attention to the body breathing. Investigating the impermanent nature, how each breath is born and then dies. The way mindfulness is traditionally taught, the four foundations, and the beginning with mindfulness of the breath, bringing awareness to the impermanent and impersonal nature of the body breathing, how it breathes all by itself. There's no true control or agency, just some influence. Just a natural process unfolding. And after the instructions on mindfulness of the sensations in the body, sensations of the breath, then the Buddha gives the instructions to reflect on the impermanent nature of the body. To remember, to recollect that this body is subject to aging. Not exempt from aging. Subject to illnesses, injuries, diseases. Not exempt. And that this body, very much alive, each breath, a sign of life, will eventually stop breathing and will be lifeless, subject to death, not exempt from the truth of impermanence. To begin reflecting on death, imagining a corpse, a lifeless body, freshly deceased. And saying to ourselves, I'm not exempt from this fate, this destiny. I too am subject to dying. And imagining the process of decay that takes place. As the elements of water and heat leave the body, and the skin begins to deteriorate, the corruption of the organs, the flesh, the Buddha recommended visualizing a corpse in the stages of decay. Imagining a body where the flesh is falling off, where laid out in an open space, a charnel ground, and the birds, the maggots, the wild dogs coming to eat at this corpse. As we reflect to ourselves, I would not be exempt from this. If this body of mine, so much alive now, was laid out on the charnel ground, this is the natural process. Until the body is mostly the flesh is gone, mostly just a skeleton left, connected by the connective tissue, the ligaments. All of the skin and parts of the body that we identify with as I or me or mine, impermanent, gone, just the skeleton remains. We reflect that we're not exempt from this fate, this destiny, this outcome. And imagining how over time even the bones would begin to crumble. Left out over the period of years and the elements. Remembering the impermanent nature of the body. Returning to the Awareness of the breath, of life, here, sitting, sensation, emotion. Perhaps there's fear, perhaps there's relief, a sense of, wow, that would be a relief to not exist. Perhaps there's fear of that, non-existence, sadness. Taking this reflection from ourselves to each other, the people that we care about, acknowledging the impermanent nature of our loved ones, our friends, parents, children, partners, all subject to sickness, aging, and death. We recollect, we reflect on death and impermanence so that we appreciate the opportunity that we have while we're alive to develop wisdom, compassion, to experience joy and appreciation. And to live in the reality of uncertainty, the unreliable, unknowable process of existence. We all know that we will die. We just don't know when or how. We know that our loved ones will die. We just don't know when. The intention to accept, to be at ease with the truth of impermanence. Without dismissing or denying or ignoring it. So I am going to talk a little bit of shit about Memorial Day. But before I do, I want to acknowledge that I know that it's can be controversial and sensitive, and that there are veterans in our Sangha. And I don't want to dismiss the grief of the loss of loved ones in the service, in the, you know, military service or in wars, or while acknowledging the tragedy of death, and, you know, honoring, you know, people who have died in wars, or, you know, so holding both, sort of, yeah, honoring the people who've died in war, and also, you know, I feel like I, you know, I'm not very patriotic, I guess, in some ways. I'm definitely not very nationalistic. And I think part of being a Buddhist and really looking at humanity and looking at all living beings and not borders and national nationalities, but, you know, just the truth of, like, you know, living beings, and not Americans, but humans, kind of, for me, sort of broke any kind of identification with, you know, American. And then just, you know, kind of even just a brief look at the history of this country and, you know, war, you know, this country that was stolen, that was, you know, founded on genocide of the native people, and the history of slavery. And, you know, it's kind of, I find it quite surprising that anybody would be really proud to be like, yeah, we murdered and we stole and we enslaved and we, you know, yeah, fuck yeah, America. Like, really? Like, that you're proud to be, you know, part of this history of murder and theft and abuse and oppression? And so I, you know, just doesn't make much, maybe, you know, I'm sure I'm offending some people, but to me, as a kind of a Buddhist sort of humanist, kind of nationalism of any culture doesn't make sense to me. And Buddhism being, you know, the Buddha's enlightenment being, you know, an awakening to radical nonviolence and non-war and non-oppression and non-harm and non, and, you know, for me, spending the last few decades trying to develop you know, practice and life and understanding and commitment to nonviolence and commitment to seeing all living beings as worthy of love and compassion, and not just, you know, kind of tribal, national lines, all living beings. You know, that having been said, I said it, but that having been said, I was also reflecting on, you know, how, like, the nonviolent stance of Buddhism, you know, and even the Buddha's life, his life story, his example of, you know, he lived in a war-torn country. He lived in, you know, in 2,600 years ago in India, there was lots of wars going on. And he took this vow, and he was a warrior. His caste was warrior caste. His father was king. He was prince. He was supposed to be the general of his father's army, which was out murdering and warring. But he took a vow of nonviolence and said, I want to wake up. I want to be free. There's no happiness in this material, worldly, empire-making business that dad's in, dead end. I'm not going down that direction. I'm going on this spiritual journey to awaken my heart, my mind, wisdom, compassion. But even in the Buddha's lifetime, his vow of nonviolence, and he was, I've talked about this recently, politically active, socially engaged. His awakening was speaking out against sexism and racism and war. And, you know, he was an activist on some level. But his own commitment was total nonviolence, and his teaching was total nonviolence. And towards the end of his life, and he intervened a few times in conflicts, and he protested and went onto the front lines, like he was engaged in that way. But towards the end of the Buddha's life, his family was wiped out in war. And, you know, he was not untouched by violence and by war, because it was a warring time, and it was in a warring country. And and when we look at the history of the planet, it's sort of a history of wars and empires making and invasions and colonialism and pretty brutal human beings. We like to kill each other. We like to steal each other's land and kill each other. And, you know, and so here we are you know, 2600 years after the Buddha, trying to develop wisdom, trying to develop compassion, you know, whatever you're, you know, really, you know, and most of us probably Americans, but, you know, with the karma of this country, living, you know, with the ongoing racism, with the ongoing ignorance of this country, living at a time right now where American tax dollars are going to support current, you know, colonial occupation, genocidal activities in Palestine. Like, you know, it's not like 2,600 years ago. It's not like, well, you know, yeah, America was 300, 500 years ago. It's like, shit's still happening. We're still paying for it. Shit's still going down on this planet right now. And remembering and being like, okay, it's the reality we live in. This is the planet we live on. Here we are. And how are we going to live our lives? And how are we going to develop, you know, how are we going to understand it? How are we going to live in it? How are we going to have an open heart and compassion and forgiveness and understanding in this world of so much ignorance, with the history of so much ignorance, with the ignorance continuing, perpetuating? Crazy, isn't it crazy to, I don't know how you guys feel. I don't usually get this political, but for tonight, for some reason, like my daughter was showing me some Trump and Biden stuff on TikTok or something. And just like Donald Trump, there's a good chance he's going to get elected again. Like, we live in a country that has so much ignorance, so much confusion, so much racism, so much, that it's, you know, I remember, like, the first time I was like, no way, that guy's a joke, they're not going to elect him. I was surprised. I was like, no fucking way, it's not going to happen. It happened, and all of the shit that's happened, it's going to likely going to happen again, or possibly. I'm not going to be surprised this time like I was last time if it happens again. Okay, that having been said, Buddhism, like in the Buddha's lifetime, and like the example of like the Tibetans are an interesting example of a culture that became. Buddhism is not a good national defense strategy. Like, it would be wonderful if we lived on a planet of nonviolence, right? Like, if we lived on a planet where, like, if of nonviolence. And that was one of the other examples I was thinking of like war-torn India. And then at one point, it's like about 700 years after the Buddha's life, there's a king, King Ashoka. And he has conquered all, he's murdered, warred, he's conquered almost all of India, right? And he's, because there's all of these different, you know, kingdoms in India. Was not, and he's sort of unified it by murder. He's murdered all of Ashoka, like kicked everyone's ass, murdered everyone. And then there's a story about on a battlefield, you know, in puddles of blood, of just carnage, Ashoka sees a Buddhist monk wandering through, and through some series of converts to Buddhism. And then King Ashoka spreads Buddhism and makes Buddhism up until then was a cult, was a small, right? India was Hindu, it was Brahmanic, it was, and this is all sort of pre-Islam. So it was all kind of that old school Hindu, you know, pre-Islam. I guess 700 years after the Buddha is right around Christ, it's still pre-Islam. And he becomes a Buddhist, he converts, he has pillars made. He then demands that the whole country convert from Hinduism to Buddhism, and he enforces nonviolence. I don't know exactly how you do that, but also, like, what a brilliant strategy. Kill all of your enemies and then demand nonviolence. No more killing. Nobody kill me, please. I killed everybody else, but please, nobody come kill me. We're now, I'm a Buddhist. And Buddhism, you know, lasts for however many hundreds of years, and then Hinduism and Islam, and they start killing each other again. I'm sure even in his time, they were still killing each other. But there was a period there where India was Buddhist and there was less violence because the religion was nonviolent. And I feel like religion's to blame. I mean, humans are fucked, but humans create violent religions. You know, Islam is very violent. Hinduism, very violent. You ever read the Mahabharata or the Bhagavad Gita? Very famous, beautiful, and there's, you know, there's teachings on nonviolence in there, but basically the whole thing is about war, and it's a rationalization for, like, you know what, sometimes you got to just kill people. Sometimes you got to, you know, it's, you know, Krishna and his, you know, his cousin, he's like, you know, yeah, I got to go kill my cousins, you know, and it's this kind of, that's Hinduism, you know, like there's parts of Hinduism that are radical nonviolence, but there's parts that are also like, yeah, sometimes you just got to go to war and just kill your enemies, even if they're your homies. Christianity is super violent. Buddhism, probably the only kind of popular world religion whose core tenet is nonviolence. Every other world religion has some justification for sometimes you just got to murder. Buddhism is like, yeah, no, never murder. Don't do that ever. You don't want the karma of that. It's not the solution. That having been said, like the Tibetan people became nonviolent, became Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhists. And then, you know, the communist Chinese were like, well, we're not, and we're taking your shit. And they didn't have much of a defense force because they'd spent so many centuries meditating and developing compassion and not national security. So I'm going to talk a lot of shit about America, but have any of you guys seen what's that show? The Man in the High Tower? So some of you have seen it, but I'll explain. So the man in the, it's this several seasons of this alternative history. If America and you know, England or whoever hadn't gone and fought the Nazis and the, you know, Japanese imperialists, and North America is actually like, I think it's the, and Hitler's still alive, and it's like, you know, the 60s and 70s, and like, what would have happened if Hitler had just like taken all of Europe and then came and took America? If, you know, if we hadn't gone and the Memorial Day, like our ancestors, whoever hadn't gone and said like, yeah, we're gonna try to fight the Nazis, and the Nazis had won and they come over, the Nazis have the United States to the Rockies. So the whole East Coast and the Midwest is, you know, Nazi USA. And then the West Coast is the imperialist Japanese. And they've split it, right? Because they were allies, right? And so the Japanese and the Germans are, you know, putting everyone in concentration camps and in North America. So I'm, you know, I'm very much committed to Buddhist nonviolence, but I also have to pause and be like, shit, what, you know, I'm happy to critique America all of the time. And, you know, but if we didn't have these armed services and, you know, if we didn't have these things like Memorial Day, where we're thinking about the wars that we've fought against the communists or the Nazis or the whoever, you know, that like, we've got some problems. Unbridled capitalism is a fucking problem. The greed and hatred and delusion in this country and on this planet is a problem, but also it could be worse. You know, that idea of like America being run by the Nazi party, not that it kind of isn't already, but I mean, even worse, like overtly. Right, there's like most of the racism is kind of covert in this country, but overtly, like, no, we're just going to exterminate the people of color. We're just going to exterminate the gays. We're just going to exterminate the Jews. We're just going to exterminate the. Fucking gnarly. So I'm not, there's that other part of me that's like, yeah, Buddhism, nonviolence is a great personal choice. But if, like, you know, if cultures become nonviolent in a country, you know, in a planet where other cultures aren't going to be, then you're just victimized. And so it's a dilemma. I don't know if any of you sit with this dilemma, but I personally sit with this dilemma of like total commitment to nonviolence. But also, I'm kind of grateful that we have, you know, some military kind of interventions against things like Nazis. things like, you know, like I'm kind of, you know, grateful that I wouldn't want to go be involved in it, but I'm grateful that like however bad I think our country is, it could be worse. There's lots of parts of it that I'm grateful for. At least we have give lip service to things like equality. At least we're trying to undo some of the ignorance of our past. At least there's some, you know, kind of intention towards equality and towards opportunity and okay, so I'm done with that. I'm going to shift to done with my political rant. There's a central part of Buddhist practice, which is remembering. Again, I'm still kind of on memorial there, like remembering. A big part of our recollection, reflection, remembrance, a big part of our practice is like you learn the Dharma. Like how long ago did you learn the Dharma? Some of you may be a little bit new, but many of us at it for a long time. You read the books, you learned, you know, okay, there's the truth of impermanence. There's the impersonal nature of things. There's the truth, you know, it's repetitive craving that causes suffering. The wise relationship is compassion, is forgiveness. Like, you know, the principles, but we forget to respond that way. How many times, you know, a day do you forget impermanence when you think, well, this shit's going to last forever? Or even the death meditation. How many times a day do you go into denial about your own death? About you forget. You think, oh, fuck, like I got time. I'll make amends later. Or I'll meditate later. Or I'll do, you know, I'll procrastinate, I'll do the dishes later, whatever it is. But there's that forgetting, and a central part is remembering, oh, everything's impermanent. I have this, all I have is right now. All, you know, every interaction, like, I don't know if I'll ever see you again. I better get complete. I better be kind. I better not, you know, make messes that I may or may not get the opportunity to clean up later in my relationships, in my family, in my work, in the world. My dad was a meditation teacher, and he taught a lot with Ram Dass, the famous early teacher. And when they taught together, they used to put a big banner out behind them that just said, remember. And I think it's one of the things from like, be here now. And it was like, remember. And they were kind of saying like, remember your true nature, remember your divinity, remember to be mindful, be here, remember. And that was like a central teaching. And it's an important teaching. Remember that you want to be kind to yourself. Remember to be kind to yourself. Remember to be kind to others. So often we get reactive. We forget. We go to sleep. We forget. Remember that you have the capacity, the potential, the ability to have compassion for your own pain, for the pain of others. Remember that, you know, this life is precious. Remember that you're going to die and you don't know when. Remember that these people that you're in relationship with are going to die and you don't know when. Remember that shit rather than going on autopilot and thinking that we're invincible and thinking that nothing's bad's going to happen to our children, or, you know, like, you don't want to go too far down the fucking rabbit hole where you get bummed, but you want to be awake to, you know, remember the impermanent, the impersonal, remember compassion, remember forgiveness. They said that eventually, I remember my father used to tell this story. He said, you know, we had the banner, remember, remember. But then we would, after a gig, we would leave and we'd often forget it. We had a whole fucking banner that said remember, but we just couldn't remember to bring it with us. In on that same kind of train of thought, there was a quote that I think I got it from my father, and it was attributed to the Buddha. I don't know exactly where it is, but I in my early years, maybe for the first decade or so of my meditation practice, I had an altar set up, and I had it on my altar, and it said, it doesn't matter how long it has been that you have forgotten, only how soon you remember. And I found that so helpful, because I found in my early practice, I'd beat myself up a lot about how unmindful I was, how often I was forgetting to be present, how often I was forgetting to be kind, forgetting to apply the principles, the teachings that I had learned. And that statement on, you know, right where I sat every day, was just so helpful to take some of the judgment off of it and just say, it doesn't matter that you've forgotten, that humility. Doesn't matter how long it has been that you've forgotten. Only how soon, just that moment, it's like when your mind is wandering in meditation. Rather than judging yourself and be like, I'm a fucking terrible meditator, thinking about planning. I just remembered to return to the present. That's the moment that matters. Not the fact that I was lost for 5 minutes and thought that I remembered and I came back here, back to this. And the present is so important. Remembering the present is so important because this is the only place, the only time that we can actually end suffering. You can't do it by thinking about the future. You can't worry your way to ending suffering. You can't fantasize your way to, but it's so, you know, the core teaching of the Buddha of present time awareness, because it's only here and now that we can respond with compassion, that we can let go of that which we're clinging to, that we can intervene, that wisdom has a chance to intervene with the ignorant tendency of our human mind. We can only practice nonviolence in the present. We can only practice love and forgiveness in the present. So that whole remember to be here now, Ram Dass, so that you can respond wisely here and now. Because you can't do it if you're not present, if you don't remember to pay attention. I think that's all I got as far as my topic for tonight. But we have some time for questions, and it can be about any of the stuff I was talking about or anything else, any Buddhist questions, meditation questions, anything about death and anything you want to talk about. Please, you can go first.
Can you touch a little, if you have any thoughts on remembering versus like non-attachment?
I think this is, let me try and see if you can tell me if I'm getting it right. It was one of the things that I was thinking about tonight of like, okay, there's so much emphasis put on the present and not being attached to the past. And, you know, present time, you know, even just what I was saying, like you have to be here present. But part of our present time is a mind that has memory. And in the present, memories arise. And there is a way and a wise way to relate to like, oh, this is a memory. And sometimes we re-experience emotions based on memories, but knowing, oh, this is a memory. Mindful of this is the past that I'm reflecting on. Without mindfulness, sometimes we get so lost in that recollection and that reminiscing or resenting stuff from the past that we forget these are just thoughts and feelings that are to be tended to with present time awareness. oh, I'm remembering traumatic experience in my life. I'm remembering loss. I'm remembering betrayal. I'm here remembering and tending to it with non, you know, hopefully some level of non-attachment, non-identification, not believing all of the narratives that our mind tells us about people, about the past, about the world, but with an openness, an investigation of like, it's so useful to sometimes turn towards your own mind, our own minds, and say, is this even true? Is this story that I'm telling myself even true? Because don't you generally just believe your own memories, your stories? But part of mindfulness and non-attachment, non-identification can just be that simple shift of like, okay, I'm remembering this. Is it true? Seems true. Is my perspective on it wise? Because of course we're always the kind of, in our memories, we're always the central character, trying to think about some of those things. I wonder what other people's perspective on that was. My perspective is like, this is all about me all of the time. But I was in Santa Cruz this weekend for my mother's 80th birthday. My mom's here. She's usually here. My stepfather, ex-stepfather was there, and I had a lot of resentment towards him. As a child, there was abuse, and my sister, it was her father at one point before the birthday party, was like, I was talking some shit about my stepdad, and she's like, dude, he's changed a lot. You got to let it go. That was 50 years ago. And I was like, you're right. That was 50 years ago. And then I was talking to him at the party, and I've done forgiveness meditation for 30 years for this guy. And talking to him at the party, and then, you know, listening to some of my sister stuff and my mom stuff. And then also realizing that, like, you know, my mom and like they were in their 20s. And just that perspective of like that tendency to hold fixed views and attached to fixed views of like, and then kind of as I get older and this realizing like, whoa, like they were like in their 20s trying to raise children with their own unresolved trauma and, you know, confusion that they brought into that. And, you know, now that I'm in my 50s, it's much easier to be like, have some compassion and remember like, okay, yeah, I'm the little kid that's getting hurt, neglected, you know, in whatever ways. But also a little bit easier to have compassion for these 20 somethings that just don't know what the fuck they're doing yet. That, you know, had their own unresolved wounds that they're spilling out, you know, not to justify it, but just a different perspective and be like, man, I bet that was really fucking hard. He actually said, he was talking to my wife about traveling, and he was like, yeah, in the 60s I was traveling with Ram Dass through India and all this stuff. And then my parents met at a Buddhist meditation. He and my mom and my stepdad met at a Buddhist retreat, 10-day retreat. He was like on this spiritual journey, and she was also, you know, kind of, they went to this retreat, they went home from the retreat, they hooked up, they were dating for a little while, she got pregnant, twins. And he was saying like, I felt so trapped. He's like, I'm a good Jewish Buddhist, and I did not want to be a father. And I just, you know, all of a sudden, but I'm not going to abandon, you know, this pregnant lady that I just met at retreat. And, you know, gave me a little bit more empathy, you know, and that sort of memory from my perspective, and then kind of seeing like, oh yeah, I can see how difficult that must have been for this confused person that was abusive and neglectful and all of those things. Also true. He's got the karma from that. But just seeing it from a different angle, seeing the story, not from my self-centered perspective, but from the other players in the memory and the recollection. Was that touching on? Yeah. Remember, but don't be too attached to your version. But tend to it. It's here. It's a memory. It's, you know, whether you're reminiscing on the good old days or you're resenting the bad old days, it's here in the present. Memories are here, present. How are we going to relate to them? Michelle, jump in.
Hi. Hi. I was entertained. Thank you for your talk.
You're welcome.
I remember at some point somebody bringing this up, but in the past, and I want to hear more about it. But like, you know, Memorial Day for me as a veteran, I think about my friends that we've lost, but I really think about the young men that have taken their own lives. And that's really challenging for me in some ways, because I think it's a waste and all the stuff. And Buddhism reminds me about karma, but like, could you talk more about karma around that?
Karma around suicide?
Yeah.
I don't want to, but I will.
Thanks.
It's such a good point. Thank you for, yeah, the memorial, you know, the military stuff. I think I saw at one point that, like, you know, more people have like killed themselves afterwards than died in some of the wars. And so it's not just the people that die in the conflict, but it's the after, the traumatic effects of being in that zone and the so many suicides afterwards. And because Buddhism teaches a multi-life rebirth, not just this life. So I said earlier, we were beginning, I talked about some reflections, and they're called the five daily reflections of Buddhism, which is, I am of the nature to age. I'm not exempt from aging. I'm of the nature to sickness, illness, injury. I'm not exempt from disease. The nature to die. I'm not exempt from death. And then the other two are everything that I cling to, that I hold dearly, I will be separated from, the truth of impermanence. And the fifth reflection is, my only possession is my actions, my karma. I am related to my karma. I am the heir of my karma. The only thing that I truly own, all my stuff's impermanent. You don't get to keep, you die, you don't take any of your stuff with you or any of your relationships with you. You just only your karma. At death, you know, so my only true possession is the teaching. So killing ourselves, as you know, Michelle, and I've talked about it a lot, I was pretty actively suicidal for a good chunk of my early life. A lot of suicidal ideation. And I'm one of those people that think of, thought of anyways, death as a relief. I think a lot of people are afraid of death, but, you know, I always felt like, what a relief to get out. And I also had been taught reincarnation. So I thought like, in my immature, like I was suicidal by like 5 years old. But I believed in reincarnation because that's what daddy said. So I was like, okay, you don't really die. Your body dies, but then you have a new life. And I was like, that sounds pretty good, actually. I don't mind getting out. I would, you know, I'll roll the dice and see what kind of family I get next time, because these hippies aren't paying attention. They've got great weed, really good LSD, but not a lot of attention. So the Buddhist perspective, is, you know, the because it's karma, and because suicide is an act of aversion to pain, it's an act of violence. I know there is a perspective that says, hey, you want out of your pain. You could even be compassionate to say like, hey, I'm killing myself because I don't want to live with this pain. But from a Buddhist perspective, avoiding pain is not compassionate. It's actually compassionate to heal pain. It's compassionate to learn to be with, and that Suicide is an act of aversion to feeling what needs to be felt and healing what needs to be healed. And so traditionally, Buddhists would say it's not such a good karma to kill yourself because you're taking your own life in a way to avoid pain, which is understandable if you don't have the tools. You know, not everybody has the tools or the willingness to kind of go through it. But ideally, Buddhist perspective is you don't want to take on that karma. You want to, because then you're just going to come back and you have the karma, not only of whatever, in this lifetime, and then you also have the karma of I didn't stick around to deal with my pain. Now, this is a very Buddhist perspective, and I feel like half of our Sangha doesn't even believe in reincarnation, so I've just lost you, and you're kind of like, well, that shit doesn't make any sense. Suicide sounds like lights out to me, and if you want lights out, go ahead. And that's been sort of my perspective, but just in case reincarnation is true. And this really, it fucked up my suicidal ideation, starting to contemplate the possibility of rebirth. I was like, what if it's not a relief? What if it's just sending me back into, all of the karma that I have, and now I got to go fucking adolescent puberty again? And probably I'm not going to get the ideal family next time because my behavior wasn't that good this time. The karma that I created in this life and how I reacted to my pain probably going to put me in another opportunity. I'll probably be born to some more, parents that are going to give me a lot of opportunities to suffer. And, probably not going to be born into some ideal Buddhist family, although Buddhist families are overrated, I'll tell you. Sorry, Mom. She's just gonna unmute any minute and have a rebuttal. I hate to say it, that's why I hate the question, because the Buddhist perspective is not good karma to kill yourself, but I hate to judge people who kill themselves in any way. I so get it. I don't want to put any judgment on it, but the Buddhist teaching is you're creating some more negative karma by that act of violence towards yourself and that aversion to pain. Buddhism is such a radically nonviolent, even the other question that I get a lot is what about killing your animals? When you're we'd call it putting them to sleep. Not good karma. You're murdering a living being who has its own karma. That and your dog that you love so much that you don't want to be in pain because you don't think it has the ability to have tolerance for its own pain, or you don't want to pay the medication bills, or you don't want to put them in doggy hospice or whatever. From a Buddhist perspective, it's not good karma to murder your animals, even if they're in pain. And we think of it as compassionate. They're in pain, let them out of their pain. Our pain, one of the things that shifts the more you meditate is the more you see that pain isn't actually the enemy. It's okay to be in pain. We have to learn how to be in pain. It's a natural part of existence to be in pain. And it's, not only for humans, but for all living beings, it's a natural process, birth, pain, death. And so ideally from a Buddhist perspective, this was not Michelle's question, but I'm riffing into it, which is, also put your dog, your animals into hospice instead of murdering them. Let them live out their natural life. They are a living being. They can live out their natural life. You don't need to decide when they're in too much pain that you can't tolerate and you want to now kill your animals. That having been said, I've killed animals before. So, but I'm giving you the Buddhist perspective. Buddhist monks, my teachers, most of them are monks, and they'll be asked questions about like, but can't I kill my animals out of compassion because, you know, like they're in pain? And they say, no, it's against our precepts to tell you it's ever okay to kill anything ever. And if a Buddhist monk from the Theravadan tradition that I study with, they said, if I actually told you it was okay to kill your animal, I would have to disrobe. It's against my vows to ever tell anybody it's okay to kill anything, because Buddhism is radically nonviolent. It's never okay to kill. And it is okay to be in pain and to be sick and to, you know, just live out that painful life. That's okay. Pain is okay. It's a different perspective. We think compassion means avoiding pain. Compassion is being with pain, allowing pain to exist rather than, you know, like remember when they were trying to legalize weed and they're like, compassion care, smoke weed so that you, you know, it's compassionate to medicate. And it's like some, you know, sometimes medication is necessary. Pain killers are necessary. Medicine, you know, weed can be, you know, applied to certain illnesses in a skillful way. But it was just such a clear kind of abuse of like getting high, avoiding reality is compassion. It's like, that is not compassion. Being with reality is compassionate. Learning to tend to what's happening. Michael, jump in.
Thanks, Noah. Really appreciate all the topics too, because it makes me like open up different lenses and lanes of thought. And I try as much as I can to stay away from like hard and fixed views. So I feel like you leaning into all this stuff's really good. And I have a question around samsara, because when you were bringing up like Tibet and the Chinese and stuff, I read this book called Eat the Buddha, and it was just, you know, about modern day Tibet. And it gave the history of the 30s when Mao and the Chinese that were in the civil war fled to Tibet. And they, you know, some of the monasteries were made of like flour and stuff like that. And the soldiers were hungry, they started eating it. And then ultimately, like you said, later on, they overtook Tibet. And like you said, Buddhism is a good national defense plan because of the nonviolence. But, you know, in that, in Tibet, a lot of the monks were, you know, using immolation as a protest. And then some of the monks said, you know, they were of the mindset that there'll always be greed, hatred, and delusion. The only wise response to your imperialism or your conquest is compassion. And a lot of the Chinese soldiers were moved by that. And, you know, spoke on that a little bit. And then it made me think of like some of the stuff that happened in the United Nations, like after all the war criminals from Pol Pot in Cambodia were rounded up, the monks were in there, like sending compassion toward them and all that, because they knew that the soldiers were stuck in greed, hatred, and delusion. And the only wise response to all that butchering was compassion. And that's pretty powerful. So I guess my question is it delusional to think that there will ever be an end to samsara? Like you always like reflect and bring up that the only wise response to all of this samsara, the world being on fire, is compassion. And then like via karma, if we awaken and, you know, we can transmit that inwardly and outwardly, like, you know, that will reverberate on and rebirth potentially, and which I'm not sure about, you know, I'm not sure about it, but I have like bandwidth open to it. So I guess that question about being, you know, because I mean, you do want to make a positive change and get involved with things and stuff like that. But I guess Buddhism or the Buddhist teachings were saying, hey, like, it's always going to be this way, but there'll be somewhat less dust in their eyes. And so that's just basically my question.
Does everybody understand the question? The Buddhist perspective that we call the human planet Earth, human realm, samsara, part of the six realms of existence, possible destinations for rebirth. There's heaven realms and there's hell realms and there's animal realms and hungry ghost realms and jealous god realms and the human realm. We call it, and it's all samsara. And the teaching from the suttas, you know, the Theravadan perspective, is that samsara is a realm of perpetual wandering that has always been fueled by greed, hatred, and delusion, and that will always be fueled by greed, hatred, and delusion, and that it's not going to, we're not going to, there's never going to be kind of peace and on earth. There's never going to be actual kind of ideal world of nonviolence, that it's a really radical choice that few make. And the Buddha didn't seem to think that eventually everyone was going to become wise. He seemed to think, and his teaching seemed to be, this is a really rare choice. Not many are going to take this path of nonviolence. Not many are going to take this path of wisdom. So that having been said, so it seemed like he didn't have any hope for the world becoming really, really wise, but more optimistic perspective that any individual who wanted to become wise could become wise, and that nirvana is, you know, the kind of end of the cycle of rebirth and end of samsara for the individual, and that each one of us could choose nirvana, which is freedom from samsara. So it's this, on one level, it's very optimistic of kind of like, yeah, we can all do this, but then also kind of like, but probably not very many people will actually choose to be non-attached, to be compassionate, to be forgiving, to be awake, you know, and not only just choose it, want it, but do the work to get there, really train the heart and the mind to get there. That having been said, I feel hesitant kind of basing prophecies from 2,600 years ago. And there's a few times in the Buddha's prophecies where he was wrong. So maybe he was wrong about samsara. Maybe we will, you know, maybe there will be enough progress that greed will end and hatred will end. And maybe eventually this planet will be free from racism and free from sexism and free from nationalism. Probably we're just going to destroy the planet way before we have a chance to do that. And, you know, humans will not, you know, not going to have a very tenable, you know, realm to exist in a couple hundred years or however long, couple decades, I don't know. So the couple times, you know, like when the Buddha, there's a couple times where he said that he thought that Buddhism would only last for this many hundreds of years. And he was wrong. Here we're 2,600 years later. I think at one point he said, I think this, you know, probably only about 500 years before greed, hatred, and delusion destroys Buddhism, destroys these teachings. But we're here 2,600 years later, still talking about it, still practicing it. So I like that some of his things that were actually assigned to him, as like he said, Buddhism would only last for a few hundred years, he was wrong. So I don't think we should have blind faith in what the scriptures say, but really the practice. How is this alleviating suffering in my life? How is remembering to be kind, remembering to be mindful, remembering to be generous, remembering to be forgiving, helpful in my day-to-day and my relationships? And how is that creating a positive change in my family system and in my neighborhood and in my society and the rippling effects on this samsaric plane, this planet that we live on? Anyways, we'll leave it there for tonight. I won't be here next week, but come to class and support each other. I'm going on retreat. It's my turn to practice what I preach. I'm going to go do a 10-day silent retreat, and I'll be back the following Monday. So I'll just miss one. Ward Robinson will be subbing for me, but come sit with him, sit with each other, tune in, and I'll be back on whatever that is, the 10th or 9th, the following Monday. Class is done by donation. Be as generous as you can be. Haven't been quite meeting the expenses here at Against the Stream, running at least a couple $1,000s short a month on just the rent and salaries. And so if you can become a month, if you're not a monthly supporter and you can I encourage people to think about giving $100 a month to the center, whether you're coming every week or not, if you can afford it, if you want to. If you're just dropping in, the donation, suggested donation is $20, $25. If you can do that, please do that. And if anybody wants to write a big check for a tax deductible donation to our nonprofit, we're always seeking some generous benefactors, donors to help us support the Dharma continuing this way, where it's not, nobody's charged, everybody's welcome. And I want to keep it like that. I've been doing this Monday night class for 19 years for donation. Every commitment to keep doing this Monday night class here on the West Side for donation. But the expenses aren't always being paid. So do what you can to help. Kiki, did you have a question about that?
Yeah, you always bring up how do we do that? Do you mean like just Venmo once a month? Like
through the, it's a good, there's a link on the, for the people on Zoom, through the website, againstthestream.com. There's in the donation thing, there's a monthly supporter. So if you go to the website and you say, I want to give $50 or $100 a month just to support whether you're showing up or not, that's super helpful. That allows us to pay the bills.
Is that okay to do, let's say that, could I do that? Is it related to Refuge, or?
Separate organizations. So when you come to the Refuge meetings and you donate, the Refuge meetings pay rent at Against the Stream for renting the space. So that does help to go pay the, to pay the rent on the space. But even if all of the Refuge meetings paid rent, which they don't all pay rent, it still wouldn't meet, the rent. So it's the Monday night Sangha and Against the Stream Sangha that needs to make up the rest of the rent. And like I said, we're falling a couple thousand dollars short a month at least. So do you have a question?
Is it the same with a larger donation? Just go to the Against the Stream website?
Yeah, and if you make a larger donation, you can go there and there's a link to, what is it, Sebastian? Is it the PayPal?
Yeah, so if you go to the donations page, you could do PayPal or credit card and you'll receive a letter back.
It'll give you the tax deduction letter. So if you're going to make something that you want to write off in your taxes, it's good to get that. Well, maybe you don't care about it, but
yeah.
Some people, there's a little tax write off. All right. May any goodness that comes from our practice and discussion be shared with each other, the merit, the goodness, the blessings of our practice, then be offered outward in all directions. May each one of us do what needs to be done to get free, and together, may we create a positive shift, positive change on this planet.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.